Today we're going to be talking about one of my favorite forms of literature, and that is satire. Satire is so popular today. I think about some of the movies I've enjoyed in the past, and examples of satire in them, Hot Shots, Naked Gun, Blazing Saddles, Young Frankenstein, Dr. Strangelove going back to the 60s, The Producers, Take the Money and Run, Airplane, This is Spinal Tap. Just a tremendous list of satire. It's always been popular. There's always satire. It goes back to the Greeks and the Romans. You can find examples of satire there as well. So what do we have? We have some literary device. It could be a poem. It can be a story. It can be a letter. It can come in any form, of course, that uses ridicule or rebuke to try to attack something that the author sees as stupidity or vice of some kind. It's on television, it's in the movies. Let me share with you, before we turn to the Bible, some examples of satire. Some famous, some less so. Let's see, here's a good one to start with. Woody Allen. I'm not a real fan of his personal life, but he's an interesting writer. He has a collection of stories called Without Feathers. And he actually does satire of the Bible. In one section, he calls it the Scrolls, claims that they found some new Dead Sea Scrolls. So you know the Bible now. You must, or you wouldn't be looking at this, listening to this. You know the story of Abraham and Isaac. And I assume you even know what the King James Version of English sounds like. I don't know why it is, but if you ever go to church, sometimes you get these people that pray and they switch over to King James English, which always seemed odd to me. But I'm sure you've encountered that King James language. So here is the story of Abraham and Isaac according to Woody Allen in this new scroll that he claims was found. See if you can hear the satire. See if you can hear the fun that he's poking at the biblical account. And Abraham awoke in the middle of the night and said to his only son Isaac, I have had a dream where the voice of the Lord saith that I must sacrifice my only son, so put your pants on. And Isaac trembled and said, so what did you say? I mean, when he brought this whole thing up. What am I going to say? Abraham said, I'm standing there at 2 a.m. in my underwear with the creator of the universe. Should I argue? Well, did he say why he wants me sacrificed? Isaac asked his father. But Abraham said, the faithful do not question. Now let's go, because I have a heavy day tomorrow. And Sarah, who heard Abraham's plan, grew vexed and said, how doth thou know it was the Lord, and not say thy friend who loveth practical jokes? For the Lord hateth practical jokes. And whosoever shall pull one shall be delivered into the hands of his enemies, whether they can pay the delivery charge or not. And Abraham answered, because I know it was the Lord. It was a deep, resonant voice, well modulated, and nobody in the desert can get a rumble in it like that. And Sarah said, and art thou willing to carry out this senseless act? But Abraham told her, frankly, yes, for to question the Lord's word is one of the worst things a person can do, particularly with the economy in the state it's in. And so he took Isaac to a certain place and prepared to sacrifice him. But at the last minute, the Lord stayed Abraham's hand and said, how could thou doest such a thing? And Abraham said, but thou said, never mind what I said, the Lord spake. Doth thou listen to every crazy idea that comes thy way? And Abraham grew ashamed. Not really, no. I jokingly suggest thou sacrifice Isaac, and thou immediately runs out to do it. And Abraham fell to his knees. See, I never know when you're kidding. And the Lord thundered, no sense of humor, I can't believe it. But doth this not prove I love thee, that I was willing to donate mine only son on thy whim? And the Lord said, it proves that some men will follow any order, no matter how asinine, as long as it comes from a resonant, well-modulated voice. And with that, the Lord bid Abraham get some rest and check with him tomorrow. Now, that doesn't strike me as sacrilegious. I think, in a way, it's almost making more fun of the King James style of English than anything else. Here's one by Mark Twain, a famous one. It's called The War Prayer. Mark Twain imagines that a war has broken out, and this is someplace in Middle America, and there's a lot of flag waving, and people are all excited, and they're bringing their soldiers to be blessed by the head of the church there, the minister, they're going to pray for their sons to come back safe to them. And in the middle of this ceremony in the church, in walks a stranger who comes up front. And he says, "I come from the throne bearing a message from Almighty God." And it says, he has heard the prayer here. But he says, "I want you to think about it." He says, "You have heard these words. You heard these words, 'Grant us the victory, O Lord our God.'" He said, "Well, okay." He said, "But when you prayed for victory, you really prayed for a lot more than that." And he says, "This is what you really prayed for. O Lord our God, our young patriots, idols of our hearts, go forth to battle. Be thou near them. With them in spirit, we also go forth from the sweet peace of our beloved firesides to smite the foe. O Lord our God, help us to tear their soldiers to bloody shreds with our shells. Help us to cover their smiling fields with the pale forms of their patriot dead. Help us to drown the thunder of the guns with the shrieks of their wounded, writhing in pain. Help us to lay waste their humble homes with a hurricane of fire. Help us to wring the hearts of their unoffending widows with unavailing grief. Help us to turn them out roofless with their little children to wander unfriended the wastes of their desolated land in rags and hunger and thirst, sports of the sun flames of summer and the icy winds of winter, broken in spirit, worn with travail, imploring thee for the refuge of the grave and denied it. For our sakes who adore thee, Lord, blast their hopes, blight their lives, protract their bitter pilgrimage, make heavy their steps, water their way with their tears, stain the white snow with the blood of their wounded feet. We ask it in the spirit of love, of him who is the source of love and who is ever faithful refuge and friend of all that are sore beset and seek his aid with humble and contrite hearts. Amen." And then this angelic being comes and to the front and says, "You have prayed it. If you still desire it, speak. The messenger of the Most High waits." And then Twain ends with this punchline sentence. It was believed afterwards that the man was a lunatic because there was no sense in what he said. Well, of course, there was a lot of sense in what he said. But that's satire, isn't it? Take something like the fervent patriotism and zeal for people to go off and fight. And Mark Twain was got pretty bitter in his old age, and he turned that around and made fun of that. So those are some examples of satire outside the Bible. But what about in the Bible? Is there really satire? Sure. Let's do this. Let's talk about let's analyze satire for just a minute and think about what elements make it up. Well, pretty obvious. One thing you need to have, you've got to have something that you're ridiculing, something, some target, the object of attack. So let me give you some examples and have you think about them. Let's take the book of Jonah. Who's the object of attack there? Well, it's obviously Jonah, isn't it? For good reason. So he's being ridiculed as the opposite of the true prophet of God, since he basically wants to do just the opposite. He's the anti-prophet. Let's go to Matthew 23. Jesus is talking about it's called the seven woes. Then he turns to the teachers of the law and the Pharisees. These are the people that the ordinary people of the place would look up to. They were their leaders. These were the honored ones who knew the law. They had studied their whole lives. The best and the brightest were in this group of people. But look what Jesus says to them. Talk about putting a target on them. He says, "Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites." I'm in verse 13 of chapter 23. "You shut the kingdom of heaven in men's faces. You yourselves do not enter, nor will you let those enter who are trying to. Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites. You travel over land and sea to win a single convert, and when he becomes one, you make him twice as much a son of hell as you are." And he goes on and goes on. He really lashes these people. But his object of attack is very clearly the sophisticates of his society. Let me take you over to Luke 18. By the way, don't you find it interesting that some people say you shouldn't judge others? After all, Jesus was sweet and kind, and you say you want to follow Jesus, but Jesus was very judgmental. So you can see him doing that there. How about Luke 18? Let's look at verse 9. Jesus tells a parable. Okay, it's a parable, but see how it's directed. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. Now, the tax collector is the lowest of the low in that society because they were collaborating with the Romans. In verse 11, the Pharisee stood up and prayed about himself. God, I thank you that I'm not like other men, robbers, evildoers, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week and give a tenth of all I get. But the tax collector stood at a distance. He would not even look up to heaven, but beat his breast and said, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. And then in case people missed the point of what Jesus was saying, he ends the parable, I tell you that this man, rather than the other, in other words, the tax collector, but not the Pharisee, went home justified before God. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. So the object of attack there, again, the self-righteous, the smug, the ones who have all the learning, the ones who have their position of authority. Let's do one more just to show you the different targets that are in here. Luke 12, verse 13. Somebody in the crowd says to Jesus, hey, teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me. And then Jesus tells them another parable. Let's see who the target is this time. It won't be a Pharisee. The ground of a certain rich man produced a good crop. He thought to himself, what shall I do? I have no place to store my crops. Then he said, this is what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns and build bigger ones, and there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I'll say to myself, you have plenty of good things laid up for many years. Take life easy. Eat, drink, and be merry. But God said to him, you fool, this very night your life will be demanded from you. Then who will get what you have prepared for yourself? So if you look at that story sometime, again, that's Luke 12, starts in verse 13, look at the pronouns. When this rich man starts talking, it becomes, I, what shall I do? I have no place to store my crops. This is what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns. I will store my grain, my goods, and I'll say to myself. So the attack there was against the rich, who make all these feverish plans of what they're going to do with their wealth, not knowing whether they will even be there another day to enjoy them. So, element of satire. First thing, you have to have a target. And we see that on television. Sometimes political figures are targeted. Sometimes it's entertainment people, movie stars, and so on. Then you have to have some way that you want to deliver it. You could deliver it as a story. That's what we saw in the book of Jonah. It could be an angry denunciation, like we just did in Matthew 23, where Jesus says, woe to you, Pharisees, and just lashes them. So it could be just a direct, blunt, head-on attack. It could be indirect, like I said, a story. Sometimes character sketches are useful. Let me take you to the book of Ezekiel 28 and see what we encounter there. God is talking against the king of Tyre. So Ezekiel 28, this is verse 2. In the pride of your heart, you say, I am a god. I sit on the throne of a god in the heart of the seas. But you're a man and not a god, though you think you're as wise as a god. Are you wiser than Daniel? Is no secret hidden from you? By your wisdom and understanding, you've gained wealth for yourself and amassed gold and silver in your treasuries. By your great skill in trading, you've increased your wealth. And because of your wealth, your heart has grown proud. And so we get this character sketch. This is what this person is like. Sometimes, like I said, it's a poem. Actually, this is in a poem form here. Then you can have a tone that you decide how angry do you want to be. I say on the dial of anger from 1 to 10, Jesus' denunciation must be about a 9, huh? It's pretty angry. Sometimes it's more restrained. It's a little quieter. Let me take you to Isaiah 44, verses 9 to 17. This is the prophet Isaiah talking about those who are involved with idols. All who make idols are nothing, and the things they treasure are worthless. Those who would speak up for them are blind, they are ignorant to their own shame. Who shapes a god and casts an idol which can profit him nothing? He and his kind will be put to shame. Craftsmen are nothing but men. Let them all come together and take their stand. They will be brought down to terror and infamy. So he says they're wasting their time, but it's a pretty restrained tone. He doesn't sound terribly angry with them. Well, all right, so we have an object of attack. We have a way that we deliver the attack. We have some kind of tone, harshness. And then, of course, if you're going to attack something, you've got to hold it up against something that you would consider a standard. Why would you go after something unless you said, no, that's not right. This is the way it ought to be. The way it is now is incorrect. For example, Matthew 6. Here's the standard. Remember we were talking about how Jesus lashed out at the Pharisees? But listen to what he says here. Be careful not to do your acts of righteousness before men to be seen by them. When you give to the needy, don't announce it with trumpets. He says, when you give, don't let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. Verse 5, when you pray, says, do it quietly. It says, go to your room. Verse 6, close the door, pray to your Father. So here are the standards. Here's how you believe, here's how you act as a truly righteous person, somebody who is aware of your own shortcomings. And you pray humbly before your God. I wanted to end this section by having you see a couple of examples I think are of really powerful satire. Let me take you to Isaiah 5. Okay, are we there? Isaiah 5. How about, let's start in verse 11. Here are some woes, some judgments that he's laying on people. Woe to those who rise early in the morning. Now, let's stop there for a minute. That's good, isn't it? To rise early in the morning? Isn't that what you're supposed to do? Get going, get on the job fast? But watch where he goes with this. Woe to those who rise early in the morning to run after their drinks, who stay up late at night till they're inflamed with wine. They have harps and lyres at their banquets, tambourines and flutes and wine, but they have no regard for the deeds of the Lord, no respect for the work of his hands. So that's pretty strong, isn't it? These people get up early only to drink. They stay up late only to drink. Let's go down a little further. Verse 20, same chapter. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness, who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. Their world is upside down. Their language is upside down. We know people like that today. Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and clever in their own sight. And then this is pretty devastating coming up. Verse 22. Woe to those who are heroes. Now think about that. Again, we value heroes, but what are they heroes for? Woe to those who are heroes at drinking wine and champions of mixing drinks, who acquit the guilty for a bribe but deny justice to the innocent. That's pretty strong, isn't it? Wow. So he's taking on these people that are in positions of authority, but they've messed the language up. They don't have any standards anymore. They drink, they carry on, and he says their time is coming to an end. One last one is Ezekiel 34. Here Ezekiel is talking about the shepherds and the sheep of God, shepherds being the leaders. And he is supposed to prophesy against the shepherds, not the sheep, but the leaders. Sounds a little bit like Jesus, doesn't it? Here's what God told him to say to the leaders. Woe to the shepherds of Israel, who only take care of themselves. Should not shepherds take care of the flock? You eat the curds, clothe yourselves with the wool, and slaughter the choice animals, but you do not take care of the flock. You have not strengthened the weak, or healed the sick, or bound up the injured. You have not brought back the strays, or searched for the lost. You have ruled them harshly and brutally. So they were scattered because there was no shepherd. And when they were scattered, they became food for all the wild animals. That's sad, isn't it? Let's go a little further in the chapter. Verse 18. He says, now what about the flock? What about the sheep? Is it not enough for you to feed on the good pasture? Must you also trample the rest of your pasture with your feet? Is it not enough for you to drink clear water? Must you also muddy the rest with your feet? And verse 21, you shove with flank and shoulder, butting all the weak sheep with your horns until you've driven them all away. Pretty sad. Pretty sad. Well, that's satire in the Bible. You'll see it in a lot of places. I know you're aware of it because it's around you all the time. It's got a noble history. And I say noble in the good sense because there's a lot of evil out in the world. There are a lot of puffed up people. And satire is, I think, good to remind us of what really is important to talk about. Yes, we still believe in standards. And when I look at person X, this person has fallen far short of those standards. Next time we'll look at, we just finished satire. We'll look at apocalyptic writing, meaning books like Revelation. So I'm sure you got a lot of questions as to what Revelation means. And you'll probably turn to this and say, gee, I wonder what he says. I may have a surprise for you.